Welcome to the podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. My name is Minnie Baragwanath, and this series is based on my book by the same name. Blindingly Obvious is my story. It is a candid and deeply personal story about my life and work as a blind woman, social entrepreneur, and innovator. I wrote it in order to share my experience of blindness with others, and in the hope that it might raise awareness and invite others to actively create a more accessible future, one that is full of possibility. A wonderful voiceover artist and now friend of mine, Romy Hooper, has narrated my full book, all 24 chapters. I do so hope you enjoy listening. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to share it with you.
13. Pioneering new ground. By this point in my early 30s, there was a definite pattern emerging in my life. I could now look back and see that I was often in the role of the pioneer. I was often the first to do something. I was the lone blind person trying something different. Or I was in a new business that was breaking new ground and was the first of its kind. I was always drawn to the edge, the emergent space and the road less travelled. Whether it was when I started university at 16, when I travelled to Japan while all my friends went to the UK and Europe, when I worked for the first community television station, Kapiti TV, when I was the first disabled student to enrol in the brand new Bachelor of Communications degree at AIT, when I worked for the first disability TV programme, when I set up and ran the first mobile espresso coffee cart in Aotearoa, when I was the only legally blind actress and voiceover artist in Aotearoa. And my new job was no different. I was now the very first person to hold the role of local body disability advisor in New Zealand, thanks to the advocacy, as well as passion and drive, of Auckland City Councillor Richard Northey in ensuring such a role was created. This meant a number of things. To begin with, it meant there was no well-established pathway for me to follow inside council. It was up to me to navigate the terrain and to make sense of what my role and purpose was. This was fantastic in the sense that I could, in theory, innovate and try out new things. However, on the flip side, it also meant that the Auckland Council, at the time, had a very poor understanding of access and was not accustomed to employing blind women in roles other than at the call centre. There were no measures in place to ensure success. And, you guessed it, this included absolutely no understanding or support for my computer. This dynamic of breaking new ground as a blind woman always included this tension of being in the new, or the uncharted. It is one of the few constant factors I can identify that has been present throughout my varied work life. So what actually was my new role as Auckland Council's disability advisor? In simple terms, I was the face of disability and the go-to person for access issues inside Auckland City Council. If there was a project underway or a query that needed an access perspective, I was the person who would be approached. Luckily, my time in America and my many years of study where I actively explored the world through a disability lens, as well as working with Shirley on Inside Out, both locally and internationally, had prepared me well for this. I had a very solid grounding in disability and accessibility, both personally and socio-politically. In addition, I was now also a member of DPA, the Disabled Persons Assembly, the main nationwide disability advocacy organisation. It was the very same organisation my fundraising efforts had contributed to establishing back in 1981, through the telethon and the Year of the Disabled. My membership and engagement with DPA further deepened my grasp of access issues, as well as the local NGO landscape, and I became so involved that I ultimately moved on to the National DPA Governance Board too. I had a growing political awareness as a member of a marginalised community, and I had also witnessed some powerful examples of political activism during my time in America, the home of free speech and personal freedom, apparently. One of the most powerful political protests I have ever witnessed firsthand was in Washington, D.C., when hundreds of disabled people from across America descended on the Capitol in protest against a piece of regressive legislation that was being proposed. I recall seeing blind people with guide dogs, deaf people signing, older people, children, families, and people with ventilators struggling to just breathe. They had all turned up en masse because they would not accept being further discriminated against. I will never forget bearing witness to the power of being in community and of strength in numbers to effect change. I had been inspired and uplifted by what was possible. In the early 2000s in Aotearoa, people seemed to grasp the importance of physical access before they grasped cultural or digital or economic issues. In those days, physical access was kind of like the gateway drug, or the easiest way to engage people in understanding access issues as a whole. It was also easy to physically see that a person who used a wheelchair might need access, whereas many other impairment types are essentially invisible to the eye, and so go unnoticed and often unprioritized. For example, you would not know to look at me that I am blind, and many deaf friends or those with learning impairments or mental health challenges would fall into a similar category. On the other hand, someone using a wheelchair or a walking frame is immediately noticeable. Many of the early Auckland Council initiatives were focused on physical access to the built environment. However, I was not, nor have I ever been, an expert on the building code or regulations. I remember one of our earliest projects was to make the Western Springs Community Centre fully accessible. At this time, there were simply no community centres where the access community could come together and meet. The community needed at least one facility in all of Auckland that felt welcoming and truly worked for them. Ideally, of course, the aim was to ensure that all community centres, halls, swimming pools, recreation centres, libraries, cultural facilities such as art galleries and museums, and so on, were made eventually accessible as a matter of course. But we had to start somewhere. Western Springs Community Centre was that starting point. Thankfully, I was not entirely alone. The technical experts we needed for such projects were close at hand and very skilled. In addition to my own knowledge, experience, and networks, the Council had also established an advisory group called DIAG, or Disability Issues Advisory Group, made up of about 10 members of the access community and sector, many of whom had exceptional technical knowledge around the built environment. DIAG was designed to represent a range of impairment perspectives from the community to the council. Many of the people on this original advisory group became and have remained friends and colleagues to this very day. They are all social change leaders and people who have contributed massively to the advancement of access in Aotearoa. They include Vivian Naylor, Chris Orr, Marie Hull Brown, Philip Patston, and many more. Vivian from CCS, formerly the Crippled Children's Society, and Chris from BLVNZ, formerly the Royal New Zealand Foundation for the Blind, were both deeply committed to improving the physical and built environments. They both worked tirelessly with council designers, architects, project managers, compliance teams, and so on for years to increase their understanding of access, particularly for wheelchair users and the blind community. It is important to note here that most of the time they were not paid for their expertise. Their time and knowledge was funded by their own charitable organisations. Council paid the architects, designers, and compliance officers to attend planning meetings, site meetings, and so on, but no one paid for expert accessibility advice. It was just assumed that it would be given for free. As the access community was so desperate to have better access, they were grateful, and for years they in turn obliged. This lack of value for accessibility expertise and knowledge bugged me deeply, and a decade later, when we set up Be Accessible, our social change organisation, one of the things we set about doing was developing a way to truly value access knowledge. My fundamental concern was that if we kept on giving our knowledge for free and devaluing our own worth, no one else would ever value access either. At Be Accessible, we set about paying our access experts properly, creating professional pathways for growth and development. And we began the very uphill battle of creating a new market, where clients would gradually start to pay for the true cost of access advice. We put a dollar value on access expertise and charged for our services. Strangely, some of the greatest pushback we received around doing this came from government and the disability sector itself. But more on that perplexing conundrum later. Throughout my life, I have regularly underestimated how deeply ingrained the charity mindset was in Aotearoa, and in the access space in particular. I now know that in the early 2000s, the world was stuck in what I now call a disability worldview. My work would soon be to try to shift this to an accessibility worldview through the disruptive social change agency, Be Accessible. And then ultimately to a very exciting possibility worldview through the pioneering Global Centre of Possibility. But at this point, while I could feel how wrong things were, how disabling things were, I could not necessarily find the words to explain why, or to offer up an alternative approach. I just knew things needed to change. I knew we all needed a fresh way of viewing disability if we were to advance access and start to truly value people living with access needs. A large part of my new role in the early 2000s also involved raising awareness about disability and access issues within the council. Since there was minimal, if any, understanding and insight into disability issues, as I've said, I spent much of my time educating staff, councillors, and other key stakeholders. I learnt so much working with all sides of the political spectrum and diverse departments. This really was my early grounding and training in how to influence and garner support through presentations and storytelling. A powerful skill I treasure and continue to hone to this day. It was also during my time at Auckland Council that I learnt that access allies come from right across the political spectrum. This was a critical insight. Support might be expressed through different language or terminology, depending on where the person sat politically. But the key was to hear and identify that it was support nonetheless. I developed some strong relationships with the councillors on all sides of the political spectrum. I recall one funny moment with a very senior person at the time. It was late one evening, and it was very dark as I went to leave the civic building in Aotea Square. We had all been told to be very careful about security, as there had been a number of recent break-ins and bold snatch-and-grab scenarios. People had been walking in off the street and stealing council property. So as I stepped outside and waited for the sliding doors to close behind me, I was extremely cautious when a blurry figure in the gloom asked if I could open the locked doors for them. I said, "Who are you? Are you dodgy?" A voice from the dark replied, "Minnie, it's me. It's Dick, the mayor." OMG, it was our mayor at the time, Dick Hubbard. I said, "Dick, you have not answered my question. Are you dodgy?" During my time with council, I also got to know a number of the central government politicians too. One day I was getting a coffee from a cafe in Aotea Square. When I turned to leave, a voice said, "Hello, Minnie. How are you?" I assumed by the very friendly tone of the voice that it was someone I knew very well. And as I did not want to seem rude or standoffish, I immediately reached out and gave them a hug. It was only mid-hug that I noticed the bright yellow jacket. As my vision focused, I realised I was now embracing the ACT Party MP, Rodney Hyde, as if he were a long-lost friend. Well, he may not have been a long-lost friend, but from that point onwards, Rodney became an incredible ally and a stalwart supporter for access. He really worked hard when he had the role of Minister for Disability. I was rapidly learning that political allies and political influence can take many different forms. Around the same time that the disability advisor role was created, in a moment of wonderful timing, central government also released the New Zealand Disability Strategy, NZDS. This was the first document and strategy to clearly set out the objectives for creating a fully accessible nation. There were about 18 key objectives, and each government department was given clear responsibilities to meet. What made the NZDS so pivotal at this time was that it was also the first tangible commitment by the government that truly acknowledged the social model of disability, the very same one I had been exposed to in Oregon as a student at AIT years earlier. The NZDS and the social model became powerful tools in my suite of emerging social change repertoire. The other critical resource that became available at this time was the extraordinary set of results from the first ever nationwide census in New Zealand to capture disability information. This was the first time in Aotearoa that we had been provided with robust disability data. And it was the start of an evidence base, something that had been acutely lacking previously. Anyone wanting to build a compelling case for investment or working in social change knows that without stats and evidence, it is almost impossible to attract money or support for change. So at long last, this was now seen as important information to gather by the government and NZ Stats. And it was at this time in my professional life that I started to really appreciate the value of numbers to convey information, as opposed to simply relying on anecdotes or emotional stories. Of course, the true magic occurs when we can combine both the quantitative and the qualitative, the stats and the stories of accessibility. In other words, we can engage both the heart and the mind of our audience and our community. Thanks to these new statistics, as well as the NZDS, this is when I learnt the compelling and powerful facts that 1 in 5, or 20% of the population, had a disability. Today, in 2022, that number has increased, and it is now 1 in 4, or 25% of the population. 50% of people over the age of 65 have a disability, and many have a suite of age-related impairments. All of us will have an impairment and disability at some stage in our lives if we live long enough. Disabled people, on average, earn significantly less than any other group in our society. However, despite my growing ability to raise awareness and deliver compelling presentations, my role to advance access was very far from easy or straightforward. One of the major issues with my new disability advisor role was that the position and the work program were structurally set up in such a way that it was extremely difficult to feel I was having any real impact. It was buried at the bottom of a massive hierarchy and bureaucracy, and I had little to no power. I recall on various occasions trying to garner support from senior members of the executive team by sending them key updates or information. This was not well received overall. In fact, one senior executive sent a scathing memo to my manager stating unequivocally that Minnie Baragwanath was not to contact her directly anymore. Mind you, that same senior executive also dismissed the formal report I sent to her through the correct channel. And in a face-to-face meeting, instead of focusing on the report content, she wanted to know how I managed to dress myself so well and put on my own makeup. This experience was not an isolated one. I had a very similar encounter with a government MP some years later, when after I had presented my vision for Aotearoa, she unkindly scoffed, "I guess you are now off to go clothes shopping." I have had this strange dynamic throughout my working life in accessibility. On the one hand, I faced all the same challenges as any blind person, but on the other hand, I was also often not taken seriously as properly blind because I apparently did not look blind enough or disabled enough or downtrodden enough. Many people were confused by the fact that I dressed well, that I presented well, and that I refused to fit some appalling stereotype that required all access citizens to look bedraggled. I think consciously, or perhaps subconsciously, there were those who wanted me and others to look vulnerable, downtrodden and needy. Then that would align with the charity model, the do-gooding model, and the disability worldview that they had established in their heads. Simply by my personal appearance, I was challenging deeply entrenched stereotypes, and as a reasonably attractive young woman, I often got metaphorically slapped around for it. It just all seemed to mess with people's stereotypes, and with the box they wanted to keep me in, along with thousands of others. My growing accessibility knowledge aside, in terms of overall work experience, I was unbelievably green and naive when I started with Auckland Council in my new role. Apart from my time teaching in Japan, this was really the first and the only time I have ever worked for a large, very established organisation. Every other job I have had was in startup, or else was a small creative operation. I often felt like a fish out of water. Only a few months after I was employed, the manager who had employed me left to take up a new role at a different council. I was so inexperienced at the time that I truly did not know if I still had a job. I somehow thought that her leaving meant I would have to leave too. For weeks, I was terrified that my role would come to an abrupt end. I was also so naive in another critical area. I did not even realize that the budget of $5,000 I was assigned to make Auckland accessible was a joke. I was just excited that there was a budget at all. It became part of the challenge for me to find ways to leverage this meager budget and to find creative ways to always do more. I actually even wrote a report called Loaves and Fishes, as a nod to embracing how to turn very little into a lot more. I also think I had a disability take on this. I was so used to things in the access space being undervalued that I did not even realize how bad this was. I now see that there is a fine line between good manners and having gratitude for something versus blindly accepting something that is actually a disgrace. The Pollyanna and the entrepreneur in me always saw the positive and the opportunity at this point. But the world-weary, experienced, and more confident Minnie, who knows how much other departments and issues are funded, and yes, also valued, would be outraged today. However, this lack of resource did invite me to be highly creative and to seek out a myriad of ways to impact change on the ground. My true secret weapon, and the thing that utterly changed forever how I viewed accessibility social change, was to come in the form of an incredible Australian access pioneer, businessman, and ultimately friend, the one and only Mark Bagshaw.
I do so hope you enjoyed listening to my book and podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. Listen out for the next chapter coming soon. If you would like to purchase the entire book in audio or an array of other accessible formats, including New Zealand Sign Language, or to learn more about my work, visit my website, minnieb.co.nz. Thank you for taking the time to listen and to be with me. See you next time. With love, Minnie B.